Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
What's good, internet? It's Friday, November 20th, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio, episode 361. I'm your host, Austin Walker. I'm joined today by Rob Zachney.
How's it going?
Patrick Klefik.
I'm here.
And Ricardo Contreras.
Hello.
Hi, Cotto. Are you like me, shining in the light of your new PS5? I guess actually it's more like resting in the shadow of the obelisk.
Yeah.
Delivered to your door.
It's sitting here. I'm looking at it. Still half in the box.
Big. It's so big.
It's very big.
I don't think we told this. This all happened off mic, but Cotto has a PS5 because of poor customer service from Walmart.com, which I awoke and my wife asked me, why are there multiple $500 charges on our credit card? And I was like, oh, yeah, guess I missed some pre-order cancellations. And I was like, no, one of them is for Austin. I'm going to expense that one. And then I mentioned, like, as we were, like, turning, like, we finished recording a podcast, I was like, ah, I got this one from Walmart that appears to be preparing to ship. And Cotto was like, well, I've been putting aside some money for a PS5. I was like, well, Cotto, I've already hit please cancel this, and the notification says, we'll try our best, but it might be too late, and it's going to ship anyway. And I was like, well, if Walmart has good customer service, then you are not getting a PS5 from Walmart. If they have poor customer service, then send me your address, and I will ship you this PlayStation 5. And on that morning, two PlayStation 5s showed up in my front door.
Wow. Thank you for shipping it. Thank you, Device, for picking mine up, at least. Yep. It's big. That's my first impression. My first impression is it's big. My second impression is I hate the interface stuff so much. I like – y'all are just so entirely right about game base, about everything about moving around, getting to stuff that I care about, etc. My third impression is that zipper really does feel that good.
Yeah, it does.
I've never been – I immediately was like, man, having a pack-in game that's already installed is the smartest thing this company's ever done. Thinking about getting a new game, getting a new console and plugging it in and having nothing to do on it, like on the day you get it, until seven updates download and huge games get onto your system, especially if, like, I haven't plugged into Ethernet, but I know a lot of people are just going to have it on Wi-Fi and it's going to take forever to download Miles or Demon's Souls or whatever. And it's like, no, let me just hop in this thing and start playing around. And Astrobot's Playhouse, is that what it's – what is it called?
Astro's Playroom. Astrobot's Playhouse is also a good name.
What was the Astrobot's Playhouse? It was Astro – okay, so to be fair, it was Astrobot Rescue Mission.
Yeah.
So that's where I get – you know, that's where I get that from. But like being able to jump right into that is really cool, and jump around and feel that controller is great. And then, yeah, like this is listening to me play Demon's Souls must be the strangest thing in the world, because the way I bounce between being frustrated at new enemy designs and being completely absorbed by level design combat.
And then also, gotta dodge.
I gotta dodge, oh shit. Yeah, gotta get out of here. I'm really enjoying that. That's like, you know, that's where I am. I'm not trying to say this is going to be a Demon's Souls podcast again, necessarily. No. But yeah, first impressions on the PS5 have been... like, it's nice. It's I like the controller a lot more than I thought I would. I knew I would like some of those features, but just holding it feels pretty good. It feels solid in comparison to the DualShock 5 or whatever it was. What was the
4.
Rather.
I didn't like that controller at all. Hey, yeah. Like abjectly every like, you know, I wrote this in my review of the PS5 where I am partial to Sony's first party narrative driven character action games. Like, yeah, that's that's my shit. But every time I picked up every time a new one came out, I was like, oh, great.
Yeah.
Really wish I could do this with an Xbox controller instead, because I just don't like holding. I've just never particularly liked the DualShock's like placement of the analog sticks, which is like really weird. It also feels cheap. The DualShock 4 feels like a very toy-like.
Especially even once they added the heft of whatever that's. Oh, you know what I'm thinking of is the worst one ever was the six-axis at launch when it felt like paper. It was I could break it with one hand. this stuff, the build quality seems nice to the degree that I'm like looking at other official peripherals and stuff. I'm like, do I need these 3D headphones? Is that
you don't? So you were asking this question ahead of the pod.
Yeah,
the 3D audio works on any pair of headphones. It's a tech that applies across devices. But there is, Sony does have a pair of wireless headphones that like are nice. Like they sent them along with like the review package. And
did you have to send them a scan of your ear?
No, I didn't. Unfortunately, or fortunately, I'm not. You know,
you got one. You're waiting to send those ear picks.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice. You know, there's like a dongle, and it works on your PC or you know Mac and stuff too. Like, it's not proprietary to the PlayStation necessarily. But I mean, it is nice to I just put it on, click on, and then poof, like, the audio's there. But I don't, it's not, nothing about it strikes me as like gotta get this over a pair of headphones you might already have. Especially because there's a 3.5 millimeter plug
jack
on the
right
controller,
there.
Right?
Yeah, so, yeah. Totally.
And you'll get the 3D audio that way, which I really cannot tell you what it is. The DualSense, Astro's Playroom does a great job of demonstrating what is interesting about that controller and what it's capable of. I'm sort of surprised there weren't any sort of equivalent for like, hey, like put on headphones. We're going to show you the difference between normal audio and, because I just don't even know what I'm looking for. It might actually be tangibly better, but I can't sit here and tell you why or how. It just, I'm just wearing headphones and it sounds like it's coming in on the left and the right.
Yeah.
So. They've also got a media remote for the PS5 that, boy, like I was hoping this would be something in the vein of like the media remote that came with the PS3. Mm-hmm. And it sure isn't. those like really chintzy smart TV remotes?
I'm holding up this Roku remote.
That's
Roku.
The same remote.
Do we have
that's
the same TV?
Remote?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's the TSL.
This is, wait, but hold this those is basic.
Patrick, hold yours up too. These are basically the same remote control.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's even got the little quick access buttons for Netflix, YouTube, Disney Plus, and Spotify. You know, the only apps you're going to need on your PlayStation. But I understand why you would do this, because the interface is clunky enough that reaching any of these things could be surprisingly tricky on the PlayStation.
Yeah. So, well, especially if it's becoming like your media box and like your kid or your partner is like, I just would like to watch the Netflix. And it's like imagining handing them a controller and being like, get over to the media tab on the PlayStation 5 sounds like we're quote unquote trained professionals. And I'm constantly lost in the PS5's interface. I like all the big swings, like creatively. I love so many of the ideas, and I'm excited for Xbox to spend the next 2 years copying some of them. But like actually interfacing with the interface itself is just really tiresome and frustrating.
There was this episode of Grand Designs, and this is going to tie in, so just bear with me.
Please.
Okay, just got to walk a couple blocks to the bar.
I just added Grand Designs to my Netflix to watch list, so.
There was this episode of Grand Designs where these two douchebags are really, they're building their dream home, and their dream home is going to be minimalist. And there's some weird dynamics in that relationship to begin with, but the point is our home must be a minimalist home. And the thing that is driven home over the course of this episode of Grand Designs is that minimalism as an aesthetic is a magic trick. It's smoke and mirrors. That to have those, like, when you see those almost like pornographic shots of like minimalist interior design where it's all clean surfaces and like no clutter whatsoever.
Yeah.
the way they saw, the way they were able to do that in their home is basically you have to like open up wall panels to get it shelving. You have to, tons of stuff is like slid behind these like really false, basically false walls, where the entire room now has a bunch of hidden crawl spaces, etc. There's a lot of weird, hard to access drawers where like, you know, cables are being stowed. And so as you pull the home apart, like when it's in presentation mode, it looks great, but to actually do anything with it, it's surprising how often you're basically like breaking a wall open and fishing around now in what is effectively a junk drawer. The minimalist aesthetic has made all storage junk drawer, storage basically,
right,
in this home. And I think this is similar to a dynamic we see in a lot of interface design. And I think the PS5 kind of falls into that trap of the PS5. If you looked at it in the still image, it looks like it has an attractive interface. There's usually a big, you know, high resolution picture dominating it. There's a lot of like, invitations on the screen. They're like, hey, want to do this activity? Want to check this out, etc. But that's all like surface level, but when it comes to actually doing anything with it, you're often having to access these weird layers of the interface to try and find whatever it is you want to access. So like the notion that you have to tab up to a media tab and then just scroll down this list of like media apps until you find the one you want, that's kind of weird and silly, but it is how they've basically created this interface where, you know, 3/4 of it are always just a big inviting static image with no interface elements, no interactive elements whatsoever. But I think it does make for a system that doing a lot of basic stuff just involves a routine amount of friction that like we'll all get used to. You always get used to the stuff. It basically stops being an issue. But it does kind of highlight the degree to which it like that aesthetic impinges on its usability.
Does that media remote have like a microphone? Like the PS5 has like some microphone features where like you can like read text. And like I used that when I was like, it's very useful for like when you're sharing a tweet with like a screenshot. Like it's cool to be able to just like say the tweet and then like tweak the text. Can you say like open Netflix or whatever on that media remote? Or is it still you have to just like press the physical Netflix button in the D-pad?
I think like so. I haven't used the mic on this thing, but that's good. Like I'm sure it can do.
Does it have it? It has a mic icon on the remote. Yeah, oh, okay. Then you can probably just say open Netflix and like.
Yeah, it also has some universal remote features, but again, like it's a useless universal remote when you've stripped it down this far. Like this is not going to control. It thought my stereo receiver was my TV, and so like the notion of trying to control an AV receiver with this is just kind of laughable. And so like it is a situation where I badly wish, especially because they'd gone to this effort of creating this like really minimal PS5 interface. If there was ever a time I actually needed a big chunky remote with lots of buttons, it's probably now. But instead they were like, you know, what if this looked like some sort of cutesy Wally piece of garbage? doesn't that look sleek and futuristic? And well, it's not.
Also, we should say it costs money. That's not a free pack-in thing, right?
No.
It's like $30 or something. And
yeah.
That's not...
I would not buy it.
Nothing. Yeah. Exactly. God. So yeah, let me just wrap back around really quick to stuff I've played. I talked about Astro's Playroom, which I'm enjoying. It's a very good cooldown game. It's a very good, like, hey, I've played some stuff today. Let me just, like, wind down and hop into Astro's real quick to just, like... run around a little bit, get some collectibles, vibe out. You know this already. You both have played this already.
Yeah, it's very good.
Also, just to be clear, I'm not stepping on Kato's toes, because Kato, I know you have it. You just said it was in the box still, right? You've not gotten a chance to plug yours in. Okay.
I have not, unfortunately.
I dipped into Miles, and Miles makes like such a strong first impression. I just love him so much, and like the way he moves in that opening segment, the way he and Pete banter is so good.
His performance, like the actor, he was when we were doing our like Game of the Year nominees. For some reason, that actor didn't come to mind, and I was very glad to see that he got a nod because it's very rare the gaming performances stand out to me in any particular way. Mm-hmm. But I thought that Miles one in particular. especially given that, like, you know, I think the headcanon for a lot of people is always like, well, there's Spider-Verse, and then, like, there's also right. this other Miles. I still think even relative to a strong performance in Spider-Verse, like, you know, this actor does a really good job of, like, you know, carving out their own version. It's still within the milieu of, like, what do we think of as Miles mm-hmm. as being, like, an amateur Spider-Man, but I think he does a really good job in this game.
Yeah, there's an immediate warmth to him in a way that even I like the Peter Parker performance in the original Spider-Man PS4 game, but that was not a necessarily a warm one. There was a degree of, like, what I liked about him was that he was beaten down a little bit, whereas this is Najee Jeter is the name of the actor for Miles Morales. It's just like, I'm rooting for you so hard, and I want to, like, be around you in a way that's, like, really good. Also, like, there is something, you know, I wish Gita was here actually to talk about this part of it, but because I think that she's totally right, just, like, on first blush, that they kind of whiffed on New York politics, and, like, the way that they're talking about Harlem doesn't land right. But in that opening mission where you're chasing Rhino through Christmas time in New York, mm-hmm. and you're going through, like, you know, you go through the open air markets down in Union Square at a certain point, like, my heart dropped, because I'm not a big holidays guy, but I'm a big autumn and early winter in New York guy. Going to those places, seeing snow on the ground, like, hits me. Mm-hmm. And in a year where I cannot do that, where I cannot go to the Union Square, like, the cheesy fucking Union Square Christmas village with a Hell friend, yeah. sucks. Like, it just sucks. And so seeing it even so briefly here, actually, you, like, hear me kind of, like, not tearing up, but, like, getting a little emotional even talking about it, because it really pulled into you know, into clarity what sort of banal nothing excursions I don't get to have this year because of COVID, and, like, I shouldn't have those. If those things were open, none of us should be going to them, etc. Right. We all know this, but it was just, like, it really was evocative in a way, as someone who, like, lives in this space and has worked in these spaces and blah blah blah, like, that stuff really, really landed for me. And then yeah, I put a bunch of hours into Demon's Souls.
We should just get it out of the way, Austin.
Sure.
We should just clear. It's gonna hang over this whole conversation.
It's going to.
If we don't just lay it out, you know, you and I both last night, we were both playing.
Is this gonna be an aesthetics thing?
No.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's like a player aesthetic. Like how do you carry yourself?
I have aesthetic notes, you know.
We'll get that. I just, sometimes you step into an arena and just you just feel it, and sometimes that arena has a big man, like a very big man.
Yeah,
and you are a small man. But that's demon. That's the Souls games in general.
Well, I was a small woman, to be clear.
You often feel small, you know, relative to the monstrosities you're fighting. But
right.
Sometimes you step into that arena and just it's over. Maybe sometimes you, I believe they call it one shot a tower knight. For example,
you got it. So the thing is, you have to take out those archers first. That's number one. That's what I learned. And then you have to hit him in the legs. You got to hit him right in the back of the foot. And then you see what happens. I'm not going to say more than that, because I trust anyone who hasn't gotten through this fight yet to just get there.
No, there is. Rob, have you touched it since we
I haven't touched anything basically since Monday. Okay. So I have not.
The next time you do, because there's a thing that can happen in this fight that is going, when it occurs, it is. The Souls games are not necessarily spoken of as, like, being particularly funny, but they have a real dark humor to them throughout. And I forgot about this one. And just the key to that fight is just stay near his feet. You're a little gremlin that just doesn't want to go anywhere but near this be this man's feet. And the only time you're going to move away is when you see him. He telegraphs that he's going to hit the ground and do the area of effect mm-hmm. That goes around him. That's the only time you move away. Otherwise, you're just a little gremlin that's just trying to, like... Right.
And it looks like if I'm inside him, yes. I don't have to worry too much about that spear.
He cannot do that sweeping spear from a distance, correct. Yeah. So you just got to run in there as quick as you can And then there is the comedy part, which, like, do you want to explain what happens here, Rob? Are you
no,
okay?
No, I don't want to explain. I want,
Rob,
I want,
you'll
I,
learn I'm, it. You'll see it yourself.
Yes. Because I want him to experience it, come back, and tell us about that moment when it occurs to him.
I the thing that I want to note is that there is an effect during that fight that I'd forgotten about that makes me want Armored Souls even more. There's a degree to which that giant knight starts to feel like a big mech because of the way damage is taken on it. You know, I have aesthetic notes. I do think that it's too, in general, its design feels like something out of World of Warcraft in this game. It's like so bright and like the change to almost like white steel plate mail from this kind of darker plate mail and bright blue from the kind of sickly green like aura magic stuff is like a meaningful change to me, but also it does still look sick on its own merits.
I think the environment, like what I'm learning as I've played further in, and I'm like, you know, I finished Tower Knight, I'm most of the way through the second world, I got to Flame Lurker and was like, cool, I'm good, I'll come back for you. I like the environment aesthetic a lot more than I do like necessarily a lot of like the creature aesthetic. Yeah. Like that part seems to be working for me. I mean, I understand all the like, but I just mean in terms of like feeling in the world, and specifically one of the ways that I think it works really well. And this may have been true if you were even stricter to FromSoft's like original aesthetic, is that it feels way more alive. And like when I go, when you in 2-1, you're going through this mining area and there are just all some of the miners will attack you, but most of them don't. They just continue doing their work. And it's unique in the Souls series in which it is rare for you to come across essentially NPCs, right? Like NPCs are usually like things characters you're talking to, your shopkeepers you're buying from. These are characters in the world doing an action that isn't inherently violent to you off like immediately. You can attack them and then they will fight you in the same way that you can attack NPCs and then they will sometimes fight you. But it makes you like, it made me feel particularly awful in the way that I was fighting these I don't know what exactly like the creatures are, that they're kind of like goblin
the miners
of, like, looking,
are you, yeah. Is that what you're talking about?
But yeah, like you're coming into this
goblins. I always read them. I guess so. I haven't seen them yet in this remake. Okay. So I haven't seen what they look like now. I'd always read them as just almost like desiccated people, desiccated humans built worked to their literal bones, you know?
And they know nothing other than work. And so they are just here continuing that work that, you know, maybe is under the influence of demon. You know, I don't know. Right. I don't know exactly.
Listen,
you know,
the quote unquote fat officials are there to keep them in line. And et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Every time you say that, I hear FAT, the acronym. And I'm
the officials from Friends of the Table are here to make these motherfuckers work.
But it's just an instance where, and I've heard that when you get to some of the other areas that are like kind of, you know, the Blighttown-esque that are like the bleakness of what it's like to be in this world is something that I think their aesthetic choices and also just the like sheer just bringing the original ideas that From Software had to a 2020 fidelity sells that in a way that feels like I didn't feel that as much when I played it the first time around. I saw it, but I didn't internalize it nearly as much as I am this time around. And maybe that's because I'm playing it a second time, so I'm spending more time looking at it. But I just feel that part of the world. So I feel so much worse about my actions, even if like I'm technically this hero character that's supposed to be saving it. Like, you know, the way I'm like going around, it's fun to kill the fat official. And like, I just took down the boss man and he's 500 souls plus and great. But I don't know. It still feels shitty in a way that I can't quite articulate that I didn't feel that first time around, but I do now.
That area, the Valley of Defilement, I think does is the one place so far where I feel like I prefer the aesthetics of the remake. And I knew there would be like
is that in
place.
World 3 or 4?
That's 5. That's World 5. 5-1. Okay. I believe that's called Valley of Defilement. That's the Blighttown place. That's the place that fucking sucks. And I think a big part of it is the original place is when I think about the Valley of Defilement in Demon Souls, I mostly think of like wooden planks piled on top of each other because of the way that play. And there is stone and I mean, like, you know, when you get to 5-2 and later in, you're deeper into the caves and stuff. And so this is an aesthetic change that feels like the stonework of these caverns. So for people who don't know, it's this kind of like 5-1 in Demon Souls is this just gross, poisonous, cavernous kind of drop into a cave system that is filled with really grosso dudes and poison rats and a bunch of shitty, just, I hate the enemies there. It's that area in this game. In the original, it feels like you're walking through a bunch of shacks and that have been like stapled onto the sides of this very tall cavern that's just dropping straight down, this kind of sinkhole. And here, that stuff is more is built closer in to and on top of stonework, or at least the stonework reveals itself more readily in a way that feels like, yeah, they just built these shacks on the side of any little crevice that they could have, or like, you know, in any alcove that existed. And so that area has worked for me pretty well. And I went there because I've always wanted to try a faith build in Demon's Souls. I've only played Demon's Souls once. I played it I played it before it came out. I played it in, or no, that's not true. It came out, just not in the States. I imported it because my friend, a friend of mine who I used to write about games with over a decade ago now, was like, this game's never going to come to the US, Austin. You have to import it. I love it. So I imported it and played through it in Japanese.
So you didn't get like the Asian version with the English localization that I only learned about 24 hours ago and I'm now think, you know, maybe, obsessed with.
There's a chance I did, but I remember needing to look at, I don't think I did, because the thing is, like, if the translation was bad enough, then maybe I still had to look at these facts to explain,
yeah,
like, what anyone was
basic
saying.
Basic
concepts, but like, and also it's still Demon's Souls, so I might have had to have done that anyway, yeah, so it's possible. Anyway, I played that game with a very basic build. I want to say it was like I really wanted to use scimitars and katanas, so it was probably a dex build that I played through with. And I'd always wanted to try a faith build, even though faith here is not as interesting as in Dark Souls. You know, you basically get miracles in this game if you use faith, and that's like healing spells, regeneration spells, you know, things.
Cure poison.
Yeah, cure poison, cure stuff like that. There's like one AoE attack that you can unlock deeper into the game. But the thing that I remembered is in 5-1, in this shitty, terrible place, which is kind of part of the way the entire Area 5 works in this game, there is a blessed mace that you can get, which is just like a mace that has the blessed tag on it. And blessed things scale off of faith. So I do tons of damage because my faith is high. And they have a passive regeneration boost on them. They just are constantly healing you. You don't have to. This is the thing about this game. It's like, you're still early enough where you could start dumping points into faith if you wanted to go pick. And also, I should be clear. I knew it was somewhere in 5-1. I couldn't remember where. So I just had to play through most of 5-1 to get this thing. And I was vastly underleveled, but was relying on a decade of playing Souls games. So I could just do it. It's going to be a pain in the ass. I'm going to lose my souls. It's okay. And I'm going to push for it. And then once I had that, I like started just jumping around from level to level. So at this point, I've fought the Adjudicator, whose redesign I fucking hate so much. The Adjudicator is one of my favorite, like, weird Souls boss designs. It feels very mythological in its creation in the original game. It's still like a gross out, again, fat phobic style. Here is a big fat character who you're supposed to be kind of grossed out by, but it leans into this sort of mythopoetics of, like, you know, I'll just say that this is a big, huge round body that's missing, that's neckless, or its neck has turned into a sort of gaping hole where a huge frog-like tongue is like undulating out of it. And then above that, somehow, the back of the emptied neck is a crown, and resting in that crown is a golden crow. And this thing in the mythology, if you read the item descriptions, is the adjudicator basically of – it's sort of like an afterlife situation where it's like the adjudicator will judge you and if – and or really the crow will judge you. And if the crow says that you are guilty or not worthy, the adjudicator will swallow you whole. And that is like classic weird mythological like demigod type situation. And here it's like a fat person with jewelry on. I mean it still is – there still is the golden crow at the top of the head. It still has this huge gaping wound where there's a huge metal, like, broken off piece of a cleaver or something in its gut. Like, it still has all of the pieces, but it's become something that's, like, gross out horror versus, like, what the fuck am I even looking at horror? And it's just, like, one of those examples of how this game just misses the mark in terms of translating or adapting some of these original feelings and ideas into the kind of this higher resolution, you know, world. So I've done that. I love 5-1 or not 5-1. I think that's is that 4-1? Whatever number that is. The Shrine of Storms area was like my favorite area in the game. With the big manta rays, Patrick. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, that boss in particular.
That boss in particular rules. So I did. Sorry, I bet that.
Did you do that
no,
boss?
No, I'm not there yet. I'm so okay. Early.
I've heard that as a particular high moment of
I'm excited.
Like, how that could look with you know, the increased fidelity.
But I'm just,
go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was saying I mentioned in the last podcast that I re-rolled as more of a melee, as like a priest build that has like decent amount of armor, you know, miracles,
it has like a heal.
It has a healing spell that like I got enough MP that I can like heal myself like three times, and then I'm probably going to put like no more points in MP. It's just like that's
almost
just
like
saves
having
me.
An Estus flask is the way
and
I think about
it. It is. And like it was like I clearly had like just 1 point under being able to use it a third time and was like, fine, fuck it. I'll use a little more MP just so I can get that third use. And it just saves like, you know, having to grind for grass and stuff like that at times. I was not nearly like, even though it was exposing different like ways that enemies acted or interactions with bosses, I was just not having a whole lot of fun with it. I don't know. That's like the magic, like playing with magic, like broke me. And it's like, this is what I think of Demon Souls. And like playing it a different way is like,
you
want to
be
fun.
Able to
and then
pew something.
Yeah. Well, I was just like, doing like so little damage. Mm. And I just wasn't enjoying the combat as much. But then last night, I got lost in the, so in World 2, in 2-2, after you fight the spider, which I'm glad, you know, little things like they keep the cheap way for you to kill that spider. Like I forgot that, you know, that's what you're supposed to do, like in order to just like work your way through it. I don't want to spoil it, but like there's lots of messages on the ground that'll point you in the right direction. You know, once you get past there, there's a whole lot of these like underground mazes where you're like, it's some of the coolest environmental design in Demon Souls, where there are just like giant dragon bones just like sticking out of like these cave systems that you're going through. Like they're so labyrinthian and you're meant to get lost. Most of the messages down there are just like people saying like, I don't know where I am and I don't know where to go. And so you're supposed to embrace it and just like go through the chaos of these mazes and, you know, just know that you're probably going to die down there and pick up whatever items you can get and come back and slowly start to piece together the layout. And when I was goofing around there last night, I came out on this message that said, only cowards go forward here, and it had tons of likes. And I was like, oh, well, all right. I can't tell if this is a troll or a bit or it's like a meta commentary, and it turned out to be a meta commentary because like around the corner was a soul that ended up being what's called the Dragon Longsword. And I never picked this up the first time around because I think for the majority of my Demon Souls playthrough, it's just like, I just kept what do you start with? The Crescent Falchion?
That's like the Crescent Falchion is like a commonly suggested early game super weapon that you can get very early in that first Shrine of Storms level because it scales. If you do Royal and then get that weapon, you're fucking good because it scales off of intelligence and you're going to have a lot of it.
Yeah.
Anyway, so what's the dragon situation?
Well, I picked up this dragon. I'm just going to hold on. Uh-huh. I'm going to paste this into. Oh, I have it in a different window. Yeah. All right. So I just click on this video. I tweeted this last night because this is me discovering what this bad boy does.
Oh, hell yeah. Set the motherfucker on fire.
Yeah, it lights dudes on fire. It has I forgot also, wait, that there
parry?
Were
is like, this a parry or is this
that's just, a parry? Okay, it's a parry. Okay. Yeah,
I was like, does it it's just a parry where you have an automatic fire kill animation?
No, it's no, and you lift the dude up on your sword as it's on fire and slam him to the ground like you're in a wrestling match. But I just forgotten that you could have weapons that have elemental properties to them, and so this weapon in particular, it just does. It doesn't do the fire attack every time. I don't think. I think it's there's a certain roll chance to it. But it's most of the time, and it just does against certain types of enemies, just like unbelievable damage. Oh. Like in this mining area, some of those enemies I was fighting, it took me like a full minute to like bumble my way through the fight, even if I'm trying to do parries and things like that. Whereas this is just like. Womp, like goodbye. Like I'm the fat officials in the area, it's like womp, like get out of here. Mm-hmm. And it's just like it was so satisfying to find this weapon that one, I really like how the sword works. Like I like that I have this poke that I can use to kind of like stab at a guy with the R2. Mm-hmm. Like I found a weapon that feels good for the build that I have. A flame weapon's not gonna help me with flame lurker necessarily. No. So I'm still gonna have
motherfucker
to
got
figure
flame
out
flame in his name.
Gonna have to figure out something else for him when I come back. But it was just really I went from I'm bumbling my way through this game and I'm suddenly going, there are other new games I could be playing. Do I need to be spending my time with this? Couldn't I do this in a month and find, you know, other
it's
small
the Drake
games
sword.
For game of the year?
I've just realized it's the Drake sword.
This one is
in effect because so in Dark Souls there's a famous sword called the Drake sword that if you
underneath the dragon
it's under the
bridge
it's the tail you shoot the tail of the dragon off
right
it's like a famous like way to get a really powerful weapon very early on in that game you can shoot the tail off under the bridge and it doesn't scale. That's the thing about that sword, it upgrades if you put upgrade points in it, if you put like whatever shards into it, it'll get stronger, but it isn't scaling off of your stats, but it's super powerful for the bulk of the game regardless. And that's I hadn't realized that the Drake sword and the Dragon Long sword fit that same purpose across those games. I love FromSoft. I mean,
I'll have to see if it. I don't know if it scales or not.
It doesn't. The dragon.
Oh, it doesn't.
Dragon prefix doesn't scale.
Gotcha.
So that's the it will. But it will carry you through most of the game. And then at late game, you'll be like, well, I'm going to switch over to whatever, this other thing I found. I mean, that's the other thing.
It's
a
very satisfying weapon.
I am absolutely playing Faith so that eventually I can get the large Sword of Moonlight, which is if you did the – did you do the Bloodborne DLC stuff?
Yeah.
Do you know that big glowy blue sword, the Holy Moonlight sword?
Isn't the Moonlight is one of those like consistent across like
– yes.
Not even just the Souls games. Like, hasn't that also been in like
Kingsfield Armored Core? everywhere. So I'm excited to. I've never played with it outside of Armored Core. I've never done a build that uses
that's
the
so
Moonlight
funny.
Sword.
The series in which most people understand the Moonlight Sword is the one in which you haven't
I've
because you did
it
in Armored Core. Is there's a lot of things that are like. Boy, that's Austin Walker. And like you could put that on a top 10 list of like that Armored Core being the one place you've engaged with the Moonlight Sword.
It's true. And it's very fucking cool. So anyway, all of this is to say I do consistently have these aesthetic hangups with this thing. Also, I fucking love Demon's Souls. I love these areas. Yep. I love the level design. All of that stuff is retained here in a way that I think still communicates what made that original stuff so good.
And it's converting a lot of people. Right. Like you got, you know, I don't know if Rob will stick with it, but I think Rob has like played enough, even if he never went back to it, could like has like a better conception of like, oh, why these games are interesting, what people get from them. I saw like James Stevenson at Insomniac, like he beat the Tower Knight, and then was like, wow, I think I'm liking a Souls game, and I think it, what makes me so excited, in the same way that we would talk about like when we played Monster Hunter, how like it's so delightful to get into a series and then be excited for where it goes next. I'm so excited, whatever your hangups are with this remake and Blue Point's choices, that it's going to get a lot of people into these games right before fucking like we're going to get a big proper next gen like From Software like Elden Ring game. Like that just makes me so excited that people like that's going to happen. I don't know, sometime early next year, first half of next year, we'll finally see what that thing is. And Demon's Souls is going to end up being like just a really cool primer for people to get excited for, you know, that game coming out sometime next year.
Absolutely. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We can talk about some more stuff.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
All right, we are back. Rob, if you have not been facing down the Tower Knight, have you been playing anything else?
Yeah, not as much as I would like, but I've been playing... Zachtronics released a new game, but kind of an odd one for what you might expect from Zachtronics. I think generally we associate them with strange puzzle games, let us say. Opus Magnum, Shenzhen IO, you know, Space Chem, things of that nature.
Exapunk. And, like, stuff that has like a very mechanical, is a hard, like gear-like, I guess, quality to it. There's lots of like moving parts that are hard to understand, but often beautiful things can happen once you have mastery of systems.
So their latest game is Mobius Front 83. It is a Cold War era war game.
What?
About... Yeah, so, like, the premise is you are with a, you know, a late Cold War military unit on maneuvers at Fort Knox, which I think was one of the major armored warfare training centers during that era. It may still be, but I think a lot of the stuff got moved to the Southwest. Anyway, you're on maneuvers at Fort Knox, and then you are attacked by an advanced enemy force out of nowhere in, you know, the heartland of America. And at first, everyone thinks it's some sort of Red Dawn situation where, you know, my God, the Russians are here somehow. But people start noticing that, as you know, the people you are fighting appear to be using a lot of American equipment and sound just like Americans. And so it begins to turn into this situation where you're trying to figure out, why are all these American troops pouring into the U.S. fighting other U.S. forces? And I think you can probably guess some of what's going on. But I talked to my friend John Boulding, who's seen the end, about how this all ties in. And you probably won't see all of it, and you probably won't predict the weird tie-ins that are happening in this game. However, that being said, I have to admit, I'm a little bit taken aback by how very traditional and old school this game is, to the point where I'm not really sure I like it that much.
And you're Rob Zachney, which is to say you have a very specific history with hex-based war games that are trying to simulate, you know, certain scales of combat. And that familiarity to me has always meant that you're predisposed towards appreciating tactics designs that don't necessarily do big flashy things, but are fundamentally sound. That is like my read of you. And so when I saw this game, and when I put my first couple hours into this, I very much thought this might be more of a Rob thing than an Austin thing. So now I'm hearing that's not even the case.
No, because I think in some ways, I don't want to make assumptions here, but like my feeling as I play it is a design that is naive of a lot of what's happened in war games in the last few years. And what I mean by that is the games this reminds me the most of are the old Panzer General games. And that has a lot of modern descendants. There's the Panzer Corps games made by Slytherin. I think they also make a series I really liked, but the name escapes me. But these are games that tend to create wargamey tactical puzzles, where it's not about confronting a situation that could be different every time, and you kind of just have to react and like stick to your fundamental tactics and game plan as things happen. It's more like you enter a mission, you see what's going on, you probably fail it pretty hard, and then you realize, like, okay, so here's what's going on. Right down to, here's where a bunch of enemy units are stashed, so I know now that there's an ambush there. Okay, I know there's some key objective units over here. So now I'm going to play all of that with foreknowledge. And just as a matter of taste, that has never done it for me. In part because what that leads to, and I think this was, the Panzer General games were enormously popular in the 90s, and among war gamers, like games that follow that template remain popular. But what a lot of that would lead to in the Panzer General games was this feeling of you just needed to solve whatever it was that the scenario designer had in mind for the exact steps you'd follow to get the, you know, the biggest victory. And I am much more partial to sort of the XCOM model, where it's like, you know, you have some idea of what you might be up against, but the specifics could change every time, and you kind of just have to react and know how to get the most out of your units. This one is very much in that old school Panzer General, very much in that old school Panzer General vibe, but it's so simple that I'm not sure it is a great competitor with the games that have taken up that mantle. And it feels really at odds with things like Unity of Command that have come out since and sort of approach some of these problems from a different angle. And so it just ends up being kind of a weird thing where Zachtronix made a really old-fashioned war game.
I so want to know what led that team here, because
yeah.
It seems so unlike what they've done in the past, which does not mean that they shouldn't make it, you know? I guess the thing that we didn't say that they made that you love is Eliza, which is a game very unlike the games that they've made. So it's not like they haven't.
But that's such a Matthew Burns game, though, too.
It is.
Like, that is the one thing I'll note. Like, it has the where there's consistency there is Zachtronix are brilliant at creating like diegetic interfaces for their games. And so this has that, by the way. So you'll have like field manuals. You have a deck of cards if you want to play solitaire.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You have a little like Shenzhen IO. There's like a little electronics, like, puzzle game. But like, yeah, I think just to your point, I think Eliza was already kind of an exception in part because it is so the product of someone else who's not part of that core like design team.
Well, that was my thing, is like, is this just the core design team? Is this also, you know, someone outside being tagged in who had some idea for a military war game? Like, what? It just seems so out of place for me. And more importantly, like, when I was playing through these levels, I don't think I had any of those moments of feeling like I'd solved something, which is what is core to the Zachtronix style. I always hit a dead end eventually with these games, and I don't have the patience to become, you know, masterful at them. What I always do is put like 4 hours in, have a really good time, hit a couple of puzzles that are just too far for me, and then move on. Here, it was not that. Here, it was like, I'm just not interested in these in these situations. I don't necessarily feel like the decisions I'm making are particularly meaningful, and it doesn't make me feel clever to get through a level. And at that point, I feel like maybe the thing that they're really good at just doesn't work with this basic design format. Like, I don't know.
I feel like, but so for me, it almost feels like, so the weird thing is, I think they're in their other games, they do not seem afraid of conceptual complexity.
Right.
And here they do seem that way. It's very strange because like early in the game, you unlock army field manuals from this period of the Cold War that sort of implies they sort of like, this is the closest the game comes to giving you a design document where it's like, look, this game isn't like a sim, but this is kind of what we're drawing from and kind of what we hope this game will evoke.
They're literal PDFs of literal like army manuals from the time, right? Like,
yeah. So like, here's how you advance.
Right.
Right, so like diagrams of like, here's how you advance on an unsecured tree line with mechanized force. Here's where you deploy, etc. Like procedures for waging this kind of war. And that's all good. But then the game doesn't do a lot with that. So a game that occurred to me a lot while I was playing this was Yujin Systems made a series of Cold War war games called War Game. And probably the best of that series was Airland Battle. And one of their insights is kind of that in this period of warfare, lethality is super high. So it's not like BattleTech where tanks can just like trade blows. It really is an era where, you know, a well-placed missile will destroy just about anything on the battlefield. So everything is a glass cannon.
Right.
And this game hints a little bit at that. It has some swingy, hit tables. You know, you can do a lot of damage or a little. There's a lot of variability. Sometimes a good tank will just explode in one hit, and sometimes it'll shrug off like three or four. But in general, you are never ill-served by just shaking all your infantry out into the forests and slowly just advancing across the map. Like, this is a game that, in general, you can reliably set up kind of kill zones and a sort of a threshing machine model, and just let the AI kind of bash itself to pieces against that, and then you clean up and win the scenario. And that's not a lot of fun, and I think the setting allows for a lot more. You know, when I talk about like combined arms tactics, I'm talking about setting it up so that you have like simultaneous delivery of like covering artillery fire, you know, smoke to obscure advancing troops, and then simultaneous arrival of like armor and infantry carriers and infantry to all like hit the target at once. This is really this type of warfare, what it's all about. That's a really complicated procedural task to undertake, and I could see Zachtronix like doing something with that. But in this iteration, it's such a crude, like Panzer General-esque implementation that it just doesn't evoke a lot of period flavor for me, nor does it really get at, I think, what makes a lot of war games interesting and cool. So, you know, it's like it's a Zachtronix game insofar as some of the story stuff around it is cool. Some of the side games are really fun in this, but the core of like the war game, it's definitely not what I was kind of excited for when I thought like, ooh, Zachtronix made a war game. They made a really dated feeling one, which sucks to say, but it's kind of where I'm at with it.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing for me ends up being like, this is so close to something like Advanced Wars that if I want that experience, I can go play that as a tile based, like, you know, similar in range of conflict in terms of the things I'm juggling in my mind style of war game, and also get something a little bit, again, for me, a little bit flashier, a little bit more for me to sink my teeth into. Or, like, you know, if I really did want to go down that rabbit hole, Rob, I would come to you and I would say, all right, give me something deeper. Give me something that you know, slides away from the abstraction of something like an Advanced Wars and towards something a little more grounded. And you would give me 1,000 different things to play. And so, you know, it is what it is. Anyway.
So is this, hold on. Is this a side game?
Yes.
Okay. I was like, I looked. Tato
has just linked an image from a programmable radio mini game puzzle game that is in this game.
Because I was looking through the Steam page, and then like this popped up in the screenshots. And I was like, now that looks like a Zachtronix game. Mm-hmm. Like,
well, if you notice the top of that, TIS 330.
Oh yeah, right. Yeah. Right, of course.
So like little shout outs to that legacy. So yeah
totally.
It's, yeah, so that's a part of it as well. I think you unlock that when you find some enemy like signals units hiding in a forest in one mission, and then it's like if you kill a bunch of these dudes over other missions, you'll unlock more of these. But yeah, so and I think the other thing, Austin, the last thing I'll say is I think there's a tendency to overestimate the complexity of these games. Like, one of the things I played last year that I really loved was this game called Armored Brigade, which covers this exact topic. It covers like Cold War warfare. We did a good 3MA on it. If you
right, I was
listen.
Like, where do I? How do I know? Why do I remember you talking about Armored Brigade?
Because yeah, I know we Troy and I talked to Rod Humble, yes. And Yeah, Ian, good episode. Boudreaux. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. But the thing is, like, it's not that hard to grok these concepts. Like, a lot of times war games are hard just because they're bad at interface design, and that game was pretty solid at it. And so it didn't take long to realize, like, okay, this is how I lay down smoke. This is how I, like, you know, deliver cover fire, etc. And that is just a hell of a lot more fun because it's not pulling those punches and does create this sense of the battlefield being incredibly perilous.
Right.
And the weapons are both incredibly powerful but incredibly vulnerable. And I think it does all of that without necessarily abstracting out a lot of the interesting complexity of these systems. And I think there's a tendency, especially with like making more approachable war games, to be so afraid of complexity that you end up abstracting it down to stuff that's actually way simpler than like even Advance Wars or Fire Emblem. It's very strange how theme, like when I think about XCOM, you know, Austin, every time you and I load XCOM 2, we're like, what the fuck is happening in this game? Like, what does any of this do?
Yeah.
Because the complexity is layered in, but there's a lot of it.
Yes.
And then I look at intro war games, and a lot of times it's like, oh, don't want to, ooh, like a second stat column that we want to introduce. That seems like too much. A third ability?
The thing that I think about a lot here is that what abstraction lets you do. And when I say abstraction here, so with Armored Brigade, if you look at the screen from Armored Brigade, what you're looking at is a map, top down map of an area, a bunch of icons that represent units, some lines indicating directions, other icons indicating locations and maybe a few other things. But then things are sort of flat in the sense that when you click a unit and you say like, here are the things you can do. It's like, all right, I need you to go this far. Okay. I need you to speed up. I need you to go in reverse. I need you to set your artillery range or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, I need you to drop smoke in this area. It's flat in a sense. Whereas it feels like with something like XCOM, it's tall, where it's almost as if there is a degree of which you have a unit, and then over time that unit gets more complex and things get poured on top of it in a way that separates it from other units technically of its type. Other ranger units have different abilities, and so their unit bars are all different, right? And for me as a player, the XCOM thing is easier because it starts it's not very tall to begin with, but you pile new abilities on top as a player learn new stuff. And so suddenly we load in our XCOM save where we have all these high level characters. And now it's really hard for us to jump back into it because it's like, what the fuck does anyone do? But when you're playing straight through, you have it's doled out to you so slowly that I have that off the gate. Whereas I do think you're probably right. The basics of something like Armored Brigade are no less complex than XCOM, but they trust you to like deploy them pretty quickly out the gate.
That's an interesting point. And I think you've hit on something really important there, which is that a lot of times what war games do not have, for a lot of reasons, I suspect budget is a big part of it too, they don't have campaigns.
No.
And so you can't have these big tutorials where it's like, okay, so, you know, here in the story, you're just leading a pretty scrappy like rifle platoon. And this is all you're going to control are like this rifle platoon and the simple engagement. And then it's like, okay, well, now you have a support tank. Okay, now you've been promoted to company commander. Now you have like three rifle platoons under your command plus an attached tank platoon. And I think part of that is the people who make war games do not have as a core competency like campaign design. And they certainly don't have like a slate of like musicians and voice actors they can just pull in the way like Zachtronics obviously routinely does. But I think there's also an element of just genre convention and taste where I go back a lot to Steel Panthers was kind of a definitive war game of the 90s. And it had really good campaigns. But what people ended up treasuring the most about that game were its mission generator. And then it was like, well, what if it was campaign generator? It just generated endless missions. And then it just gets like bigger and bigger and bigger. And I think in war games, there is this tendency to be like, I do not want, like bigger sandbox means bigger game, more fun, better game. And I think for a certain type of wargamer, that's true. But I do think it leaves a lot on the table in terms of if you design a good campaign that will be fun to play through, you can actually have a pretty high ceiling for what you're asking players to do that doesn't turn people off. Because, yeah, I think Armored Brigade, if you boil it down, is pretty straightforward. Command Ops, really challenging game, surprisingly like straightforward if you see like what it's asking you to do and how to play it. It just doesn't give you a conceptual framework for what the various options that you have are able to do. And I do wish like I saw that more in traditional war games. But I think it does lead us to an outcome like this where to make something entry level or mainstream, it means you kind of set the bar on the floor. And most people have been playing mainstream tactics games are going to step right over that because they're used to way more complicated, interesting shit than this. And people who are playing war games recognize what this design is drawing from, and it's kind of outmoded.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is a bummer. Well, you know, again, we say this a lot, but I like it when people take swings, and this was a swing from them. Liking that they take swings does not always mean liking, thinking that the swings hit, you know? Or being happy with the outcome. So we'll see what they do next. I'm always curious. Kato, can we Destiny minute? Can we get a Destiny update? What? Because you're it's raid time.
Oh God, I installed it.
Yes,
that's right. I had to. Rob, how are you doing? I'm sorry. How did you start a new character? How is that going for you?
Okay. So
Rob hits the tower knight and he's like, well, time to install Destiny.
No, I finished that bear game and I got depressed. And I was like, life is meaningless. Time to install Destiny. And so I was just pissed and I just needed to shoot things. And I was like, fine, you know what? Let's get into this. And so I had been given a Beyond Light code for Xbox.
Ah,
I never played Destiny on Xbox.
Destiny's free on Game Pass.
Is it Kato?
Well, I mean, that's like, you know, I mean, you're paying a subscription.
Yeah, that's
No, but even Destiny
is straight up free on Stadia. That it's actually free on Stadia. Like they're just away
the Destiny 2.
Let's see. No. I got a press release about it.
It's free to play. The base game of Destiny is free to play for everyone. There's like a certain amount of stuff you can get without paying Bungie anything. That includes the introductory missions that are part of New Light, which are this new set of mission and quests that is supposed to be a better on-ramp that, from everything I've seen, looks like the best on-ramp they've had in ages, in literal years, for Destiny.
Well, I can still pull that in. I can still then try that out on PC. But on Xbox, what I did was I was like, okay, I want my hunter. My hunter that I've abandoned from launch, that I've not touched in like literal years.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did the entire Destiny cross-save rigmarole, where I had to unify the different platforms and let Bungie sign in to all my different game platforms.
Yes.
And then it was like, okay, you need to be very careful with this part because what you do is irrevocable for 30 days.
90 days.
On 90 days, even worse.
Yeah.
Which platform's characters do you want to be playable across all your accounts? You will lose the other characters temporarily. They're not gone forever. But if you push this button, you will have one platform's characters to rule them all and bind them across the Destinyverse. And all those other characters, if you created like a new one on PC, a new one on Xbox, they will be locked away for a little while. 90 days. Can't revisit this decision for 90 days. And then you get like four menus. It's like, are you sure you want to do this? Like, look, this means your PS4 characters will be the only ones you can use. And I was like, yes, let me use my hunter. And so I launch into Destiny 2 on Xbox. It looks just like I remember, but now it's snowy. It's icy. I am my hunter. My character talks now.
It's true.
This freaked me out.
Funniest fucking thing, because they talked in Destiny 1, just stopped talking in Destiny 2 though.
Huh?
Yeah.
Did they?
Yes, 100%.
What?
Go watch cutscenes from like
I
the Taken
Destiny
King.
One.
Go watch cutscenes Destiny from like one. The Taken King. You're fucking bantering with the ghost. You're bantering with the ghost as you're driving to the dreadnought. Like
Kato,
100%.
Stop making stuff up, Kato. Kato, this is like this you claim
think,
is
hold
disputed.
On. You think I would lie about Destiny? Yeah, I would I never lie I about do. Destiny. God no, damn it.
Let's not say things we can't take back, Kato.
Kato's love is pure and honest.
I just look. So I don't remember that these dudes talked. But anyway, so my dude's talking to my ghost. yeah. He sounds like now just a standard like protagonist dude.
Yeah.
He's like Varix has a lot to answer for killing Cade, and I was like that son of a bitch. But then I heard on Twitter that Cade might have died in what sounds like basically was a prison riot.
Oh, dude.
And yeah. That yeah. might mean, like, was Cade a corrections officer?
Dude.
I mean, the Vanguard is the police, basically.
Literally, it's the prison break that Cade dies in is all of, it's like Batman getting killed in Arkham is like yeah. the thing that happens.
Yeah.
It's like, I put half these people away. We can't let them escape. And it's like, oh shit. I didn't know you were sending people to an eternity prison, Kane.
Yeah, and I do remember the grimoire like having a little like excerpt about Varix being like, boy, I sure do feel weird about having a fight to the death fight club that I'm running here.
Yeah, I was going to literally say, not just any prison. The prison that the Guardians would go into and kill the prisoners in order to get rewards from the fucking Awoken.
Mm-hmm.
But, okay, but it does sound like in some ways that prison was also awesome, so who's to say if it was bad or not? But nevertheless, so I was like pretty pissed at Varix, but now like hearing that Cade was basically killed while people were escaping this nightmarish Chateau d'If does kind of make me wonder like who really is the good guy. And boy, if that isn't Destiny, like who can really say who's the villain here? Anyway, so I had to go to find Varix in his Ice Station Zebra. It also reminded me of things that just like bore the shit out of me with this game. Just the like, where could Varix be? And you find this one little like, cold weather like hab station, basically like an outpost, and it's like we had no idea where Varix could be. Quick, use the scanner, let's find some clues. And immediately the new waypoint pops up, and it's like, yeah, you just walk along the path another like 50 yards and there's a cave where Varix is gonna be. And like just the standard Destiny, like, you know, the implication of a big world, but everything feels like it's on a, you know, it's a postage stamp. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so I go through, do the intro shit. I'm like, I seem to have a lot of gear I don't remember having. So it just seems like they gifted me a lot of like level appropriate gear for the stage of the game. I have no idea what's happening. but I do all that and I'm like, well, boy, I should fill in some of these gaps. And I pull up the map and I'm like, okay, where was I now? I didn't do any of the Shadowkeep stuff. And it's like, you don't have Shadowkeep. And I was like, the hell I don't. Of course I do. Not on this platform.
Not on this, yeah.
So, now, got Destiny 2 Beyond Light playable on Xbox One. I've got Destiny 2 Shadowkeep installed on my PS5. Shadowkeep playable on PS5.
Uh-huh.
This is how I'm going to have to Destiny now.
Wow.
Destiny now is I'm going to have to like play old content on the PlayStation.
Yeah.
And then like new stuff I'm going to play on the Series X. And damn. Then I suppose I can do a new light character on PC. And yeah.
You
I can
do
confirm
the new light character wherever. It'll carry over. You can even check out the new light.
I threw the switch, Kato.
No.
I got cross save enabled.
You can do those quests on any of your old characters. There's a little kiosk next to the postmaster that'll let you pick up the quest line if you want to just do it on a character that already exists.
You should do it just to get those stats, just to get the numbers go up easier, honestly.
Yeah.
It's worth doing it. You'll run through it. It's fun to go back to the Cosmodrome. It genuinely is fun to go back to the
I'm
place from Destiny 1.
Sure. Yeah.
The Destiny 1 demo, you know?
I've already been... They've also made like fun changes in certain areas. There's mm-hmm. a strike there that is slightly different than it was yes. the first time around. There's cool. also lost sectors didn't exist in Destiny 1, so they've added a few of those, and some of those are really cool. There's a neat like secret labyrinth in one of the corners that is fun.
I got to run some strikes. I was like trying to level up and get past the 1200 soft cap. So I was doing the Vanguard Strike playlist last week, and I finally get to see like Forsaken and Shadowkeep. I was like, Crimson Keep, is that what I know it's red. I don't Shadowkeep strikes, and they rule. They like there's the one where you go back to the prison and there's like some train stuff.
Yeah.
Is sick. The one from Forsaken where you're like going between realms as you chase like a witch also fucking slaps. That strike design corrupted. Yeah. Uh-huh.
That one's great.
Strike design has gotten better. Though I actually don't love the strike that is in Beyond Light. I've cooled on Beyond Light since
which the Vex one you mean?
Yes, the Vex one. Is there a second one that I'm missing?
No.
I thought there was only one strike so far.
I think I'm just thinking of like what's it called? The other strike that came with this is on the Cosmodrome, not on Europa.
Right. Yes. Right. Which one? And that's fine. But I mean, it's simple. It's meant to be simple because it's the first strike that new players will play. I don't mind that one so much. But the Vex one did nothing for me, basically, especially in comparison to those Forsaken ones that I had just done. The way it slowly doles out the aspect and fragment stuff through what is very grindy content post game or post campaign. You know, it's weird. It's Destiny. You beat the last boss of the campaign and then you're expected to keep playing, and they do a good job of giving you things to aim for.
Yeah.
You can keep talking to NPCs who will give you like, hey, here's how you can get this exotic weapon. Here's how you can get these extra upgrades. But the thing you do in that situation is just like, you know, go kill 18 people with your cryo powers.
Right.
Go kill, you know, 30 people with rocket launchers, whatever the thing is. You know what I mean? Whatever the set of three objectives you have to do is.
Right.
And they're all kind of boring, and to have to grind that out just to get to the thing that I think is mechanically interesting, which is the fragments, the deeper degree of customization in Destiny around your character abilities, really just like bummed me out, because it was a reminder that fundamentally they aren't making the game for my schedule anymore, which is fine, but it's just not, it's just truly not who, I'm just not in their sights.
Right.
It's like, or I am, but only in the sense that they're going to give me an 8-hour campaign to play once a year and I'll play that. But if I want to get deeper into the character build stuff, I'm going to need another 30 hours on top of that to really dig into it. And that's just not, and that 30 hours to just taste it, to really enjoy it, I have to play it all year through the seasons, try Nightfalls, you know, try to get together a raid group, you know, and all that stuff to really enjoy it. And I just need to admit to myself, I'm not in that. I'm going to dip in every year, taste the campaign, be like, wow, this is cool. Maybe then check in again before the next big drop, play the stuff that's released in the last year, and then keep moving, you know?
Yeah. I think that the rate at which you get fragments and aspects and stuff that's supposed to be like the editable stuff in the subclasses is way too slow. But the one thing that they did do smartly is make a lot of those quests basically kind of background stuff. So while you're leveling, you're going to hit those things kind of naturally, right? It's like things you're already doing, less than a thing you have to stop like doing activities to go do, right? So like just passively, as I was grinding to get up to raid light level, I like unlocked the grenades and like unlocked my two fragments for the week. And the fact that like the fragments are only two a week is kind of like wild to me, that like,
yeah, dude,
you can only like, no matter how much you play, you can only get two of those anyways.
Because that means at first that is what I read that finally put me off of it, because I thought like, okay, well maybe I'll just come back in 6 weeks and all of these will be unlocked or easy to unlock. Do you know what I mean? And that's just not going to be the case. Like, I'm going to have to keep grinding at this rate to get them. And that sucks to me.
Right. It's just like, I mean, it'll only be easier insofar as you might not be fighting as many people to do the same thing sometimes.
Sure.
You know? But that's literally it. It's very much built for the hobbyist already, right? Like that was always kind of the game, but I feel like they've expanded.
Which is ironic because giving me that stuff is this thing that would have made me, could have pushed me over to being more of a hobbyist than I am.
Right.
Because it gives me something to bite into and play with. Maybe they'll just take a different tack next year because they'll have doled out these fragments for a full year. You know what I mean? Maybe the next campaign will be the one where they start you with a new power and then you unlock fragments through the campaign. I don't know. We'll see.
Right. Right.
Anyway, it's not, I'm not like, I still enjoyed my time with it, but this is the thing that keeps me from staying with it.
I've been enjoying it so far because I'm already on that track of like, I need to grind out for the raid, cause I'm very excited to do a blind raid. Again, it's been a year since we've had one, which sounds like not that long of a time, but actually Destiny had raids at a much faster clip before, so it feels like kind of a big gap.
Yeah. But,
you know, that's fine. It's whatever. I'm excited to do one again. But since I already had to do that grind, I ended up passively doing all these other quests, which normally would have been... those quests used to be separate. Like you used to have to kind of stop leveling in order to do other things and kind of make progress in other quests. They weren't as like stackable that way. So that's that was a welcome change. And like, I really did enjoy specifically the amount of story beats that they have behind the Exo Stranger stuff. Like all of that was pretty neat. And like that made that first week like really like great for me, and I'm excited for to see where the season is going, because they just started it and they brought back Uldren, right? Yeah. Which has some great, like, you know, like they're kind of picking back up on the like vibes of Forsaken with that seasonal stuff, you know, the spiders involved. There's like, you know,
it's clearly like it's a direct carry,
right,
you know,
right, because it's picking up from
where that story left off. Yeah,
Uldren, and I'm really enjoying that season activity where you like you build up a charge on like this item that you've got in order to lure out these enemies that have been corrupted by the hive god Zivu Arath, and it's this fun little like public activity where you'll see this like kind of green glowing enemy. And you'll get them down to a certain amount of health, and then they'll like run away, and then you have to kind of track them through the world, through this kind of you know, leftover goo traces. And then once you actually get there, it loads you into a separate like little boss fight with, you know, it's just a couple ad waves and an interesting little like you have to have a certain buff in order to damage the boss. It's like a fun little thing. It's easily repeatable and quick though. And it lets you get you get to choose your rewards, which is very like they always have one of these kind of things each season where it's like, okay, I can focus like on this little lure. I can say what thing I want to lure out, and depending on what thing you pick, you get a different reward. So it's like, oh, I need a set of arms right now. Let me pick the one giant shank that'll give me a set of arms. And it's really nice to just be able to have something to more specifically like target certain gear that you want.
Right. You know your number on your, like you said, your arms, your legs or whatever are bad. Let's focus on that. That's neat.
Let's boost that up. And there's even mods that you add to the lore that will also change like even more specifically, like I want this set of perks, or like I want this amount of a certain stat on armor, for example. Like you can really drill down and be like very specific about what your reward is, which is very nice.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Before we wrap up, two pieces of news. The first is that this morning, IO Interactive announced that they got the Bond license.
Yeah,
they're making a Bond game, which is wild. What do y'all
think? I think that could be really cool.
Me too. Real quick,
if they're gonna make another Bond game. You know, if like the way licensed games have just changed over the last, I guess you have to like think of it the breadth of like 20 years, but like think about like the way that stuff used to be made. Like this is actually like maybe it'll be bad, but it's like if you're gonna like pull out of the sky, like who would you want to make
a new better spy fit game than most? Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Other than like EA just getting the exclusive license and then
sitting on
like
it,
or one of like Sean Connery's final projects associated with 007 is to like make new lines for, was it from Russia with Love, I think is the last one EA made when they had the rights to that.
It's easy to imagine a different studio getting this and just immediately just being like, all right, cool. Like, I'm not buying this.
Want to play this set piece from Casino Royale?
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
So that's the thing that I'm really curious about is, so I am the Kane and Lynch liker on this podcast.
I think it goes beyond the Arrested Development meme of there are dozens. Like, people like that series or like saw enough in it that it would, if they were to revisit it, I think people would be genuinely excited about it.
Yeah, I think it's misanthropic and miserable and dour in a way that that actually is really good for a shooter like that. And I think it delivered on that surprisingly well. But what makes this interesting to me is, in some way, I can see a few different ways to go with this, especially with where Bond is at right now. There is a profound goofiness to Hitman right now as it stands, that could dovetail very well with just what Bond generally is conceptually and what it's been throughout its history, which is kind of heightened and absurd. And to some degree, I can see like what IO have been doing with Hitman.
Yeah, really I want them matching. To embrace like, you know, Goldfinger and like the heightened absurdity.
Sure.
Which maybe didn't feel that but way. Go ahead.
No, but I'm saying, but that is also not what Bond is right now.
No, like,
the Daniel Craig series has really tried to reinvent it as more of a dour post-Cold War Bourne-esque type thing. And that is where I think, like, okay, then at that point you're more in Kane and Lynch territory, where like every victory is hollow. You know, you will commit unspeakable violence, and at the end it'll be like, well, that really accomplished nothing. And like, nothing more Kane and Lynch than that. And that seems to be a decent fit for where Bond is. I'm curious if you'd square that circle.
I would miss so much of the playfulness of the Hitman stuff, of like finding solutions. Hitman is a game that is filled with interesting gadgets and like weird moving through environments in a way that like spy stories often have. A combination of disguises and social stealth and manipulating social situations to give you access and stuff like that, that, you know, maybe it bounces between those modes, because if you do want actiony James, contemporary James Bond stuff, you're right that I think Kane and Lynch is, it fits there. But I would hate for it to just be a straight action game and to not have, you know, it's already easy to think about my favorite Hitman levels from Hitman and Hitman 2. And say like, oh, how would you put a James Bond story in this location? And in many of them, it's just like already there. Do you know what I mean? You think about the expensive resort in the Japanese mountains for rich, like, James Bond's been there. Do you know what I mean? Even some of the less ostentatious places, like not just the super rich hotels, but you think about the suburban area in Hitman 2. And like, there was a fantastic James Bond scene in my mind in which he has to go to like suburban America and deal with the locals. Like, that'd be a fantastic sequence. And so I think that if they stick to their mode, that they've proven that they can do, like, and obviously if they just make a Hitman game that's filed Agent 47 and written James Bond, people will be like, I think there will be backlash in the sense that like it will feel like not selling out, but just like, hey, come on, why not just make another Hitman game? But I think that maybe
undersells, because those games don't sell enough.
Exactly. That undersells how big a well-made Bond game could do, especially if it onboards people well, you know, and gets people into it.
Yeah, there's a world where they could, like, if they were given the license to, like, merge those worlds, they could come up with something, like, pretty fun and goofy. I don't know. I do worry about that, though, because especially because the folks that operate the Bond license, if you read about the history of how those movies are made, they are exceptionally hands-on. This isn't just like, we found a filmmaker, go make your Bond movie. It's like, there's a lot of fingers in the pot, and maybe that won't be true of the game, where they're just like, video games, like, go do your thing. At least conceptually, I'm glad. If someone's going to fuck it up, it's fun to see IO like take a shot at it.
I think the thing that gives me some heart is, I think if anyone can slide something really interesting and fun past a bunch of goons who think they're managing a prestige brand.
Uh-huh.
I think it's probably IO. Their games have like a slick, chic aesthetic that I think like speaks really well to the type of shit that the 007 brand has been associated with of late. And I think like, so I think this is probably the only way to get a great game out of this because I think, you know, the stuff IO makes can certainly look like it fits what they think the 007 verse should look like.
Well, they don't, but even in the promotional stuff for Hitman is not necessarily like, and look, he threw a pizza box at this guy and like, isn't that funny?
It's always super serious.
It's played super straight. And so, yeah, maybe that's what happens. It's like all of a sudden this 007 game comes out and people are like throwing a shoe at the supervillain and they won the mission. They're like, well, we can't control what the players do. You know, we just give them a bunch of tools and like, here are our systems. And all right, I see you, Rob. I see you. I see the path forward on this
one. It's good. I like it a lot. Quick disclosure on this as we transition to a new topic too, is Friends of the Table, you know, co-member Janine Hawkins works at IO, so obviously all of my analyses are completely shot through and compromised.
Also, as you're gonna extract this segment and then send it to her and just like, yeah, just there's some food for thought, you know,
just some food for thought, just make this happen. Janine does like Janine has like the best job in the world, which is she gets to write response. I mean, it's very hard work. I don't, when I say the best job, I don't mean it's not work, just to be clear, but she gets to write a lot of the dialogue responses from NPCs in the world when things like pop off or just like any sort of ambient dialogue. So like, I don't know, she's very funny. And every time a guard says something funny, I'm like, that was Janine. I know that was like a joke based on some bullshit movie I know that we watched. Anyway, speaking of Janine, last month, I actually played through a bunch of Dragon's Dogma with Janine on her YouTube channel. As like a Halloween thing, which was fun. And I raised that because moments ago, someone over on the Reset Era forums pinged me in a thread, which does not happen often because I don't post on those forums. I have an account, obviously. But shout outs to J. Walter Weatherman over at the Reset Era forums, who just says CC the Calcutech. And that's in a thread called Dragon's Dogma 2 possibly leaked through Capcom's schedule.
Oh, yeah. Shocking.
Shocking. Shocking. 2022 is what this schedule looks like, it says.
That makes sense.
That makes sense to me.
That puts it a full, you know, three and a half years after
in the generation.
Yeah. A game that was probably in pre-production while DMC5 was. We should caveat that like,
who
the
situation knows?
Is more than like it's coming through like a massive hack that occurred to Capcom. Really, like the closest equivalent is to what happened to Nintendo earlier this year with the Giga leak, in which they like all sorts of things have been leaked from this, like from what is here appears to be a legitimate schedule of things that maybe not in totality, but things Capcom is working on. Including like scheduling for like the RE4 remake, which we've heard is coming and is being allegedly worked on by the RE3 remake team, and is coming in 2023. But even as small as internal documents outlining how Capcom thinks its previous games have like treated women badly, and like specific examples from their games being like, this is stuff that we're not maybe going to do going forward. Like, this is where, like, interesting. Fascinating insight, you know, maybe don't maybe not great to like go in and just leak all that stuff completely out devoid of context, but it does seem it fits with everything we've heard in the past in terms of what there were. I mean, you know, you don't make a fucking anime that nobody was going to watch unless you had like a broader
doing
why did that even come out? Why did that come out this year?
I don't know. It wasn't good. It was also really bad.
Unless you were going to put out a PS5, you know,
which they might
still going to do that.
Right.
Did you boot that on PS5? Did you see?
I did.
How does that run?
It wasn't running great. I'll be honest. I didn't have a great time with it.
Isn't it the case that the PS5, I might have this wrong, but the PS5 benefits from PS4 Pro games with uncapped frame rates, whereas the Xbox is able to do more like brute force work to get games to run.
I think so.
Better.
So I want to see it on an Xbox, because I bet it looks great on the Xbox.
I'm going to load up here. YouTube.
And
see if anyone
Xbox
has done
Series
Dragon's
X,
Dogma.
Dragon's Dogma. There we go. That's reporting right there. I don't think
that's.
No, I see one X. I don't see Series X. Unfortunately.
What are we doing? Come on, people.
Come on. What are you doing? Where are my dog
stands? 3 years ago, comparing PlayStation 3, PlayStation 4, that's not what I'm looking for. No. All right. Well, you know what, Emmanuel? Here's what I'm doing the rest of the day.
boots on the ground reporting right here. Anyway, we should start wrapping up. I'm excited about that, but until it's real, you know, it's very funny, by the way, Patrick, that today is the day that this leak happened. We were talking yesterday for some stuff that will be announced eventually that Vice is doing regarding video games about hacking and archival and getting information through, you know, less than legal means and stuff like this. This has been very funny to add to that conversation. Mm-hmm. That's just a little tease for you. We got some shit coming next year. It'll be fun.
Yeah.
Any other final words before we wrap up today? I hope this weekend is good for everybody. I hope everyone can kind of just chill out. I feel like we need one. Kata, are you streaming the raid?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Can people find that?
I'm just going to do it on my personal. Should I do a Waypoint?
Huh. Do a Waypoint.
What you should do is you should do it on your personal and have Waypoint host it. So you get the follows to your personal account, but you get the boost from the Waypoint account.
Cool. That's right. So you can watch either one, I guess. There we go. But twitch.tv/Kadokun, CADOKUN.
There we go. Where can people find you on Twitter, Kata?
@A_Kato_appears. Also, the start time for the raid is 1 p.m. Eastern on Saturday.
Why don't you get twitter.com/Kadokun?
I did. I had it. I had it for a second. I was trying to take the kun off of all of my like usernames.
I see.
But the person who has @Kato is a Brazilian designer who I talked to and they didn't want to give it up. They were very nice about it, but they didn't want
to. They're using the account. If someone's using the account, I'm not trying to.
They are, but sometimes I feel like people don't care about usernames, and this person happened to care about the username, you know?
I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. It was
fuck. Fine. Huh. No, okay, never mind. We're good. This is the person who I checked this. So like once a year, every year, I'm like, is Austin Walker available yet?
Uh-huh.
Not Austin_Walker. And at this point, I can't give up the underscore because it's like part of the brand.
Sure.
But I thought for a second that Austin Walker had switched people, but I just remembered, no, this is that person. He's just locked his account now. So that's fine. Shout outs to @AustinWalker. Don't @AustinWalker, no. Please. Do
be
not.
Cool, people.
It's fine. Just chill.
I'm begging you to be fucking chill all the time. Where do people find you, Rob, being chill on the internet?
@RobZachney.
And Patrick.
I mean, @PatrickKlubek. Still haven't seen Potato Marshall out there in the Soulsiverse.
Is the spear the what's it called?
Scraping spear. I think so. Yeah, okay. I there was some worries that you know some of like the rough edges of Demon's Souls that are kind of like player hostile. Like for people who don't know, like there's an item called the Scraping Spear that essentially just ruins your equipment. It doesn't. It just breaks it. You have to go and fix it. But so one of the ways that people would fuck with folks in Demon's Souls, and I believe they got rid of this stuff in the subsequent games for. Maybe understandably, but I've been hit with it, so it's not as though I have not experienced the Scraping Spear. But someone comes in, they have no interest in killing you. They just come in, poke you with the spear, break all your stuff, and you got to go spend thousands of souls to fix it all up.
What?
And then there are I don't want to explain how it happens, but there are also instances in which you can be de-leveled. The game can send you back a soul level, which is, all told, not that big of a deal. You're going to be, you know, have tons of souls and be over-leveled to some degree, no matter how you play the game. But the way it happens in Demon's Souls in particular is truly a delight. I beat that boss pretty easily the first time around. I don't know that it'll be the same the second time around. Maybe I won't find it as funny.
Yeah, the second fair.
Time, but
fair.
Yeah, I mean those are all those curiosities that make me glad that Demon's Souls is the one that got remade because it has so many strange
so
things that
if they had just remade Dark Souls or something like
you know? And like I feel like that stuff's all inevitable. But I'm glad because Demon's Souls would have been it wouldn't have been the one I, like, if, not that I would have been the one I picked. Maybe if I was a marketing person, I don't know if it would have been the one I picked. I would have found some way to make a deal with Namco to, like, we're going to remake Dark Souls. Like, the big one, the breakout hit, it's been long enough. The game would look, you know, like, I could see the argument there, and I'm glad that
they
the
already
weird
did that,
one,
though. It's called Dark Souls 3.
Boom, oh, get him. That's right. That's right. I gave that game 4 stars. I actually liked that game a lot, but I'm going to hype up Kato because I'm his friend. It was a good one. Get him.
Thank you. I also enjoyed that game, but it was very, it was, the jump there was very,
just to go back 1 second for Demon's Souls, it is remarkable that we're both playing that game because we do not replay games, Patrick. Like, no. We don't do it. We, just you and
don't.
I are alike in
don't
this
have
way.
Time.
We, like, I have like a few exceptions where I'll dip back in as a, like, again, Dragon's Dogma is a game that I play to like clear my brain. I replay like the Blendo games, 30 Flights of Loving, and
but do you even are you replaying
sometimes?
Dragon's Dogma as much as you are just booting it up and fucking around in Dragon's
Dogma?
Well, I know,
like,
cool,
I do it
film.
Like once a year. I put like another 15 hours into a save. Sure. You know what I mean? Like, I'm like slow playing it across many years as a way of just like, I just need to clear my fucking head. But like with, beyond that, there's a very few games that I revisit. So the fact that despite my problems with this game's aesthetic choices throughout here and there, I'm still loving it. So it is what it is, you know? So,
Demon's Souls.
Excited
to find me on Twitter.
Play it for the first time.
You should. I'm excited to hear what you think.
What, so you've played everything but Demons?
I haven't played Dark Souls 2.
I enjoy Dark Souls 2.
Man, you know what? Actually, the one, like,
that's the one.
If you could wave a magic wand on, like, the one they should go back and, like,
bring
the
shadows
do
back. That's what I want From to do. I want From to be like, Elden Ring is actually an expanded version of Dark Souls 2.
The Dark Souls 2-iverse. Yes. I mean, Elden Ring's made with Namco Bandai. So.
There we go. It's possible.
I'd be curious to see the, Blue Point did do the thing with Demon's Souls that they did with Shadow of the Colossus, where they have added a couple Easter eggs. People are still trying to figure out what's behind a door.
I bet it's tendency related, world tendency related, or something. I don't know. There's a single door
that says that like it has the text that would imply you need a key, but it is clearly not a key.
And there's like one pickup behind it. People have figured out a way through photo mode to see where it goes, basically. Actually, that's what one last thing I want to say about Demon's Souls. Actually, last thing is the fact that you could pause this game via photo mode now is that's the biggest change in the game. If I had to like be on my shit Austin Walker philosophy cap on, the fact that the world can pause now because you can go into photo mode is the single biggest change in the game in a way that I think changes what it is, like fundamentally.
What happens if someone's in your game?
I don't know that you can go into photo mode if.
Yeah, that's probably, they just don't let you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Or maybe it stays live, like, I don't know, but, like, that, the ability to pause the game and step away from your system in that way is completely, or to pause it and go to a computer and say, where is this thing? How do I beat this thing? Is a,
I wonder, like, how they could have, I wonder if there were, like, would have been ways to solve that where it's,
or
like,
metaphysical, actually, but.
Where you could have, like, watched a goat, like, hey, do you want to go back and watch your, like, we recorded your playthrough.
Right.
Like, here's a ghost version of your playthrough. At any time, you can pause this playthrough and you can take a photo from your play. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I wonder if there's ways they could have split the difference and a lot, like, not paused it. I mean, I understand why they did, like, the pause discussion on Demons is, you know, I get it. I don't consider it to be,
this
like,
is not me saying that this is
worse. Yeah. No, but it is.
This is a huge change.
My understanding is that was a, there were long discussions internally on whether they should not do that. It was not something done lightly.
I should be clear about this too. Is like when I say that there are I rarely suspect that the changes came without thought. I just wouldn't have ended up at the same place that these people ended up at most of the time. All right, that's gonna do it for us. You can follow me on Twitter at Austin_Walker. You can follow for now until I get Austin Walker. Don't. I don't care. I like the underscore now. That's like it's.
Yeah, you
I
wouldn't know. Be able to do it. Yeah. You could own it. You could. It could just sit there. It's like, hey, follow me at. Like the one tweet is follow me at
Austin_Walker. Drew, you can find me on Twitter, Waypoint, twitter.com/Waypoint. Also, send your questions to gaming@vice.com.
Hey, people should review this. We never do that, like this stuff. Like, people should like write some reviews. Yeah. Like, it's probably been 3 years since we've asked people to write reviews. Like, go write a review for the for the podcast. Like, or just star rate it, you know? Like, just do that. Quick, if you never done
know
it,
what,
think about
you
it.
Know, didn't we do that at the back end of, was it Waypoints? No, wait.
Be good and rewatch it.
That makes sense. Right.
Yeah.
I was like, Max, when was the last time we did do that?
Max says, if Michael Bay is an auteur, explosions, is Zack Snyder also an auteur, slow motion CGI? Thanks, Max. Good question. I'm not going to answer it. Hmm. You can send your questions to gaming, but people should think about it and decide if they think that that's true or not.
You should answer it at the beginning of the next episode.
We'll have to sleep on it.
Yeah.
gaming@vice.com is where you can send your questions. We'll read them on the air. Always. We definitely do it often. thank you to Bowen for letting us use a track. Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. Find out more about that at waypoint.com.
Be good and answer it, our new Q&A podcast. We had to start a new podcast that's only about answering questions.
I'd do it. Shit. See if Jason will prove it. See if we can get some budget. y'all don't gotta write stories. You can just answer questions all day, right? Fuck. All right, that's going to do it for us. Have a good weekend. And as always, fuck capitalism. Go home. Jump into it. Let's time dot it is. Kato confirming 361, right?
Yeah. 361.
Time dot is.
Is that. Is that the hum or is that something else?
That's the hum, I think.
Sounds slightly different.
Rob's icon is just straight up green.
Yeah, that's.
But I don't hear anything from him, but obviously the Discord is picking it up.
Yeah, I can.
Ooh! International Men's Day. Let's go.
Excuse finally. Me.
But also, it's World Toilet Day.
Yeah. I feel like we've done this.
Yeah, there we go.
Have we? Probably. We've been doing this for long enough that there's been another.
Another November 19th.
The real thing on Time About Is today to talk about is this quote from Steve Maraboli, who I have motivational speaker, sure. Okay. Internet radio commentator.
Oh, I don't like that. That sounds like a right wing talk show host.
Says here, you got to be in the now to create and experience the wow. You got to be in the now to create and experience the wow.
On this,
why is that a quote?
Our precious International Men's Day, remember, you must be in the now to create and experience the wow.
All right. Let's do a clap. Scroll
up from this quote.
You want to do, let's do 39 seconds. All right.
God, it's so weird that the hum is right at my detection threshold for this. This is so annoying.
It's fine. It's better than you cutting out, I think.
Yeah, but yeah, it's deeply fucking annoying.
No, this sounds like the exact kind of thing that, yes, Kato, can you just tell Rob, don't sweat it. I got it. I'll figure it out in post.
Yeah, but
Rob,
I do.
We'll spend the entire podcast just seething. Because it would drive me crazy, too. Like, mm-hmm. That's...
It's fixable in post, but I wish it wasn't there.
Fair. Man, there's so many things in life, Kato.
That's true.
Yeah.
Damn.
Surprised to find out that World Toilet Day is not some sort of parody around International Men's Day.
No.
It's actually...
Is that like secretly some way like, oh, actually we're like spending money to, you know, like give proper plumbing infrastructure to like...
Almost certainly, right?
Yeah, it's
the UN
days.
That's like...
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Toilets are important, etc.
Uh-huh. Yeah. What if toilets got to do with climate change?
Interesting. Yeah,
isn't that one of Trump's like funnier bits where he's like constantly obsessed with like appliance standards? I can't remember. There was something where he talks on and on about.
Sounds like him.
Like your clothes not getting as dry. It's like it's one of his. It's one of his top 10 like weird. No one's quite sure what to make of it. Not really sure where it came from, but it's
right.
You know,
the that's him in his like borscht belt, like on stage trying to connect with people thing.
Mm-hmm. Remember when your dryers used to work? There's a
right,
whole
exactly.
This is gonna be my home. I'm gonna have to look up this bit.
All right, ready to do it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.